This episode of the Halloween Podcast is brought to you by Acorns, the app that invests your change automatically. If you're like me, you have zero inside of your savings for future you. What Acorns does is rounds up all of your debit card purchases and invests that change for you automatically. I got started months ago and my account is slowly growing for future me. I didn't even notice it coming out of my bank account. It's that subtle. Support the Halloween Podcast by signing up using our link. You get a $5 sign-on bonus, and so do we. Just go to thehalloweenpodcast.com/acorns, click on the banner, and get signed up. That's thehalloweenpodcast.com/acorns. Now let's get the show started. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Halloween Podcast. I am your host, Lyle Perez, and today we are in day 10 in our 31 show. It's a 90s Halloween countdown. Joining me is my good friend and co-host from another podcast, Lassa. Lassa, how you doing?
Hello, I'm doing great, especially because we are recording together again.
Yes, it seems like it's been so long since we've recorded anything together.
Oh, so long.
Yes, he is from our other podcast. It's a 90s Christmas podcast, so if you like Christmas stuff, check that out. You'll be able to hear me and Lassa riff on a lot of 90s Christmas content, and you might even hear us cry a couple of times because there's been a couple of specials that kind of got us.
Oh, yeah, very, very emotional punch in those cases.
Yes, but today we're not talking Christmas. We are talking Halloween. We're talking 90s Halloween. With the movie Sleepy Hollow from 1998.
99, even.
98? No, I could have sworn it was 98.
Sorry to disappoint, but no, it's actually 99.
It is 99. Well, it was probably filmed in 1998.
That might be the case, and it came out in February 2000 in Germany. So we have three dates in this case.
Yeah, November 19th is when this one came out, right after Halloween.
Yeah, pretty fitting. I think they should have released a little bit earlier, so it could be like they could have amped up from the pre-Halloween fever, and then Right. Everybody would go as the Headless Horseman or anything, because this was actually a pretty big hit when it came out, so it wouldn't have been too far-fetched for people to...
Oh, yeah. Definitely. But looking at the numbers, I can see that, it was a pretty big hit.
Yeah, worldwide.
Yeah.
Which was even in Germany, it came out in an edited version in the cinema, so it could be rated 12. They cut out a few bits here and there, pun intended.
Probably a lot of the beheadings.
Some of them, yeah. I think there's a total of 18 beheadings in this movie.
Wow, 18 of them. Well, I mean, Sleepy Hollow isn't necessarily a Halloween movie per se. It is scary in a way, and it sure does have a lot of jack-o'-lanterns.
Yeah, it has. It's not about Halloween, but it oozes that Halloween atmosphere. Yeah, it has scarecrows, jack-o'-lanterns with certain light and feel. And also the original story became very popular around Halloween time and all of that. Because the story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving, was first published in 1820. And it was one of the earliest examples of American fiction with enduring popularity. So it was actually a pretty, pretty big piece of culture for America in a lot of ways. And yeah. I would actually argue that the Disney adaptation from 1949 might be a little bit more Halloween-y, because it's a little bit more playful and all of that, and it also has a jack-o'-lantern imagery. So I don't know what would be more ideal to watch around Halloween.
Yeah, it does get you in the mood. I mean, everyone knows that it's a ghost story, basically. The Headless Horseman is basically a ghost, but you can, like, touch him. But I thought it was weird that he's the Headless Horseman, but he, in a lot of the close-ups, he really has no body.
Like, no body.
there's the only thing it is clothes.
Oh, but that's what you mean. You mean you don't see the neck?
Yeah.
I know that. Yeah,
it's a ghost. It's a ghost.
Yeah, it is a little bit because I guess it is a ghost with his clothes on, because you see the skeleton laying there in his grave at one point. Mm-hmm. But later, when he gets the. By the way, people, just to get it out of the way, there are spoilers in this. If you haven't watched this one, maybe watch it before you proceed to listen. But a lot of people know this movie, and if you don't mind spoilers, just keep listening. When he gets the skull back at the end, then it just the skin grows back and all of it. So yeah, it's a little bit convoluted in terms of what exactly are the rules. But I don't mind it. I mean, it's ghost, can do anything, whatever.
Yeah, the horse was very real, though.
Oh, yeah! Which is really interesting. I mean, it's also kind of like a demon horse, because it comes out of this hellhole dimension, but it is as real that even normal people can ride on it, and... yeah, but in my head canon, it would be... It's actually really funny, because when the horseman dies near the beginning, like the actual horseman, his horse seems to have survived because it stands at his grave. And then, was the horse cursed too?
I don't know. It seems that way, that it would be cursed, but I don't know. I always find fascinating the lore behind a lot of stuff. Like, yeah. how do ghosts really disappear? Do they, like, go through a wall and then they're gone? Do they dissipate in front of you and then they're gone? Like, what actually happens for them to leave? That's what I'm always fascinated about when it comes to ghost stories.
Yeah.
And in this case, I'm like, yeah, why is the horse, like, a ghost as well?
In this case, it's witchcraft which brings him back to life. So... in the original story, there really doesn't have to be any reason. It's just a ghost. And even in the original story, which is a funny thing, it's even suggested that it isn't a ghost, that it's actually a Braum, like the guy from the village playing a prank on Ichabod Crane.
Okay.
So it's vague in the original.
That's kind of what I was thinking as I was watching the movie, was, oh, it's going to end up being a joke. Because I haven't seen this movie in such a long time that I completely forgot everything about this movie. And when I was watching it, I was going, yeah, it's going to be like, because he's like a detective or something like that, a constable. So he's there to figure out who's really causing the murders, because he thinks it's somebody in the town. He doesn't think it's a real ghost until he starts seeing some weird stuff. And then he goes, okay, maybe it is a ghost.
Yeah, that's the theme of a movie, and that's really cool, all of that. But it's funny how the movie gives it away much too early, because when we see the second victim, the guy who watches over the village in the first night, you see, like, the fog blowing out the torches. Which is clearly not something natural. So the movie pretty much gives it away in the first 15 minutes that there's something supernatural going on.
Yeah, I kind of wish it didn't. I kind of wish it would have let us believe that it was somebody in the town. But once it started getting into all of the witchcraft stuff, I was like, okay, it's less interesting, because... I know now what's causing it. Like, if they would have kept it more obvious in the beginning, it would have held my attention better.
Oh, yeah. But that's something, because they... Johnny Depp even gets it wrong when he discovers the skeleton, and he says he comes from hell to collect his head. Yeah. And he collects heads until he finds his own. The head was stolen. But then later we find out that's really not the motivation. He is pretty much the puppet of the witch who is causing this. Yeah. So it gives us a false... It gives us like a false resolution to all of this, because later on he's wrong again. So it's just... It keeps surprising us in that way, which is on one hand, I mean, it's kind of fun, but also like we have settled on this solution now, but then it turned out to be something different that could also be frustrating potentially.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the original tale? I never read it firsthand, but I know what happens and how it ends.
I've never read it either. Only like the Headless Horseman. I never really went deep into what the lore was behind this story. I do remember that this movie was out there. I just, for whatever reason, I never wanted to check it out, probably because it was Tim Burton. And yeah, a lot of people love Tim Burton, but I'm not that much of a fan, as you can tell by, like, I didn't really care for Edward Scissorhands. it's just not... my thing. Like Beetlejuice, not really. So the only thing I probably really liked was the Pee-wee movie he did.
Oh, yeah.
Big Adventure. That one I liked because I thought that was funny, but it tries to be weird, and I don't know. But
yeah, it's funny, and we will go into the history of all of that. I watched this when did you watch this first? Can you remember?
I was in high school, so it had to have been somewhere between 2000 and 2003.
Ah, okay. I first saw it when I was about 15 or 16, maybe, with one of my younger brothers. It was dark and cold evening, and halfway through we decided to turn on some lights. We were both scared and fascinated by it, and as a huge Burton fan, I wasn't using Mark.
Do you remember what scared you?
I particularly remember being scared, like, by the atmosphere, and okay. the jump scare with the witch in the cave got me. And at the scene where the Iron Lady opens up and his mother comes out and the blood is pouring out onto the camera, we stopped the movie and looked at each other, and I was like, do you want to turn on some lights? And my brother was like, yes. I mean, as a huge Burton fan, I was an easy mark, of course, but it right. also was actually the first horror film I've ever seen. The first, which is clearly, like, labeled as a horror film in a way, but we will get to it, because it's funny. Is it horror in a way? Like, it's mixed with camp, clearly.
Yeah, like, it's very campy. The stuff to me wasn't necessarily scary. It was, like, over-the-top scary. Like, it was too over-the-top to where it wasn't as scary, more theatrical than anything.
Yeah, it's not a true horror film. It's obviously an homage to the Hammer films, especially those from the, like, 60s, 70s, 80s. It is obvious that they try to recreate the feeling of a classic Hammer film. The plot is far more complicated and layered than the original work it's based on. The production design is rich and detailed. The color palette is muted except for the blood, which has that trademark bright, almost neon look about it. And there are even two actors who were in Hammer films before making an appearance here, Michael Gough and Christopher Lee.
Okay. Yeah, I did notice Christopher Lee was in it for a couple minutes.
Yeah. I think I have here a comment from Burton or somebody about the making of this movie and why they wanted it to be like this Hammer thing. Yeah. You know, in a way. There's a certain thing I've always loved about horror movie actors, Burton said. There's a separateness about them. They're just doing their own thing. You feel their aloneness. You feel like they don't socialize much, and they're having some problems, are somewhat tormented, are somewhat living in their own head, and that's why you relate to them.
Okay.
And the Hammer horrors do this, like, they enhance elements and accentuate quality in terms of like colors and all of that.
Right.
And the Hammer Horrors did it without knowing they were doing it, and we are doing it because we like it.
Yeah. Well, to me, it does seem over the top, so.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's also what the old Hammer films were. The idea of this movie came from Kevin Yeager, who fell in love with the tale as a child and later found success in Hollywood as a special effects and makeup artist. I think he worked for, like, he might have worked for, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He worked on tons of horror stuff. He also was a TV director. And he worked out a screenplay with Andrew Kevin Walker, who also wrote David Fincher 7. And Paramount got the rights, but it took a few years until Burton signed up, whose prior two films hadn't been financially successful, Ed Wood and Mars Attacks. And it was actually it was actually after John Carpenter's Scream and Walker's success in 7 that the projects came into motion and the studio considered Burton as a director who had been the producer's dream candidate since day one. And Burton had just finished his pre-production work for Superman Lives or Reborn or whatever, we talked about this already, which died before the actual production began. And now he was free again, and after he took Sleepy Hollow, the script was briefly touched up by Tom Stoppard to add a tiny bit of humor to the whole affair. So in the original script was way darker and more violent. And in case that name sounds familiar, Stoppard also wrote Shakespeare in Love.
Oh, okay.
Just for the listeners out there. But yeah, a lot of history behind this. And what was your overall, like, rewatching it again after all these years and having forgotten it? What was your impression? Like, did you like it or didn't you much care for it?
The biggest thing that got me was I could have sworn that Ichabod Crane was more like a soldier, but in this one he seems like a scaredy cat. Like, he's scared of everything. Which, to, like, when I saw, there was another Sleepy Hollow show not too long ago,
The
last 5 years, and that Ichabod Crane was, like, more of a, like, a fighter, but...
Yeah, I mean, he died in battle, right, in that series? They showed, like, in a flashback that he dies in battle and trying to kill the horseman.
Yeah, he's battling the horseman, and that's kind of what I thought was going to happen here, because, like I said, it's been such a long time that I didn't remember what this movie was about. As watching it, I'm sitting here going, man, why is he such a coward? I thought he used to fight the horseman.
he kind of does briefly here and there when he learns to stand up for himself. In the original tale, he's a teacher. That's also the case in the Disney movie. And he's also like this in the Disney movie. He's this lanky, goofy guy. Johnny Depp actually wanted the character to be even weirder.
Yeah,
I think there's something in the trivia about that. He wanted to have like the big ears and the long nose too to make him more ugly, but they didn't let him do that because that would have made him look like even more like the actual cartoon character. Have you ever watched the Disney cartoon?
No, I have. Like, I've seen stills of it, but I've never, like, seen the thing.
It's actually, yeah, it's one of the two segments in Ichabod and Mr. Toad. And I watched it not too recently, for the very first time, because I've heard so much about it, and being a fan of this a tale, in a way, I just wanted to see how they did it, and which is really cool. Let me see. It's very entertaining. It's an entertaining take on the story with a finale featuring the horseman being especially fun in a creepy way. And I wouldn't be shocked if Sam Raimi was hugely influenced by that sequence. There's so much. There are even a little nods here and there. The way like the jack-o'-lantern flies directly into the camera. That's from the cartoon.
Yeah.
There's also... When he lands backwards on the horse at one point, that's also in the cartoon.
Okay.
So there are a couple of nods to the cartoon here and there, and which is a funny thing because the kind of like the villains of that movie, where it's like Brom is like that big, brash, muscular guy from the village, and he's pretty much the rival of Ichabod Crane and this kind of like love triangle, and he has like this kind of assistant, and they look exactly like Gaston and Le Fou from Disney's Beauty and the Beast. They're pretty much, I guess, the makers of Beauty and the Beast looked back at Ichabod Crane like, hey, let's just take these two characters and flesh them out more.
Yeah, it kind of seemed like he would have been a better choice as like a tough Ichabod Crane.
Yeah, I mean that's exactly his purpose in the tale and in the Disney movie too. Like in the Disney movie, he's not exactly a villain; he's more like a bully, basically. But he seems to be, you know, this like nice muscular guy, and he just gets a little bit more grumpy when Ichabod arrives and is this kind of rival to him, and then he tells that story of the Headless Horseman to scare Ichabod, and then he gets spooked in the forest, and then he just leaves, and that's also how the tale ends. How like he's never found again. Like if it's just this smashed pumpkin on the bridge, and they don't know where he is. So it's a very dark ending in a way. And here they reference it, but it happens in like the first 40-45 minutes of the movie. Yeah. And it turns out to be a prank.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool because it looked, when I was watching it and I saw the pumpkin fly at him and smack him off the horse or whatever it was, I was all like, man, that was pretty cool. And then I saw that it was the guy playing a trick, and I was like, wow, he was aiming that well without being able to see.
So exactly.
So I was like, yeah, that was weird.
So let's maybe talk about who is in it.
Okay.
A little bit more.
Sounds good. Obviously, we had Johnny Depp.
His third film with Tim Burton after Edward Scissorhands and Ed Wood. And this was part of a path of Depp settling on playing quirky characters.
Yeah. He likes the quirky characters.
During the 90s, he really... he jumped on the path and hasn't left it since. Anyway, in a few days, I'm going to review a new movie that's coming out with him. I'm getting a special a screener for it for review purposes, and he plays the villain, I think.
No, okay. I didn't know he was still acting.
Oh yeah, he is. He still is from time to time. Yeah.
I thought he had trouble with domestic violence problems or something. So
apparently, it turned out that he was actually the victim of that stuff.
Oh, so is he going to go back to pirates?
I don't think so.
No.
They are working on kind of like a reboot.
Oh.
with like female main characters, I think, with actually really really cool choices to play, and I'm like I'm all here for it when you bring back the fun into the series again. Who knows what could come from it. But yeah, we also have, I mean, we're all familiar with Johnny Depp, but we also have Christina Ricci, who mm-hmm. isn't in much anymore but was a big star back then.
Yeah, she was a Wednesday in The Addams Family.
Which is pretty much a Tim Burton film without Tim Burton being attached. Which is really, really weird. Because her performance in this is so interesting and committed. She fits right into the time period and the kind of movie this is. And it feels, her performance feels so old-fashioned and classical in a way, and being the kind of actress she is, it really surprises me that she wasn't in more Burton films. It's like they were made for each other.
Yeah, she does kind of have that look to her. I don't know, every time I see her, I always think Wednesday Addams.
Oh yeah, it's, yeah, Wednesday like, Addams. I know from a couple of other stuff too, but I can't play.
She was in Casper, I think she was into.
Yeah, exactly, which also has some Burton vibes here and there. But yeah, it's really funny. Also, like, she at the very end, she wears that striped dress, which makes her look like Beetlejuice's daughter.
Yeah, she does. Wait, is she Beetlejuice's daughter?
No, that was, I mean, Beetlejuice doesn't have a daughter, but
Winona Ryder,
who also has like, who also is like the perfect actress for Burton films. But yeah, Winona Ryder was considered for this role but turned it down. So that's telling you something. But yeah, I'm just surprised that Christina Ricci doesn't show up anymore in any Burton films. So strange.
Yeah. She was pretty young, but she was what, 18 at the time? 18 when this one came out?
99, so was a few years after the Addams Family stuff.
Yeah.
Miranda Richardson is in it. We have Michael Gambon and Michael Gough, who worked with Burton on the Batman films. We have Jeffrey Jones, who also was in Beetlejuice and Ed Wood, Richard Griffiths, Ian McDiarmid, who we all know as the Emperor himself. He's the guy who what is his role again? Let me look it up. What was the name of Ian McDiarmid's character again? Oh yeah, Dr. Lancaster. He was the doctor.
Yeah.
But most of us know him from Star Wars. Mark Pickering as young Masbeth, who becomes the assistant of Johnny Depp. And we have Liza Marie, who was Burton's muse at the time, who had also appeared in Ed Wood and Mars Attacks. She plays Ichabod's mother in the flashbacks.
Okay, yeah.
And as Ichabod's father, the tyrannical priest, we have character actor Peter Guinness, who still appears in a lot of British films and TV. Most people might remember him from Alien 3 and Hogfather. Alien 3 might be one of the bigger movies he worked on. And in smaller roles, we have Alan Armstrong. He is one of the like the police chief, pretty much, at the beginning.
High Constable,
who stands, Casper Van Dien of Starship Troopers fame, mm-hmm. as Braum. And, of course, we have Christopher Walken as the Hessian Horseman, who we also saw in Batman Returns.
Yeah. And he looked pretty scary in this one.
Oh, yeah, he did. Ideal casting. Like, whoever had that idea.
Yeah, and he does not say a single word.
Absolutely. He just says,
he does scream, and you can hear the Christopher Walken voice in that scream.
Yeah, it's so, you can so hear incredibly it. Perfect. The funny thing is, he didn't tell Burton until after he was cast that he actually didn't know how to ride horses and that he was quite afraid of horses. So whenever you see Christopher Walken sitting on a horse, that's an animatronic horse. And you can kind of see it when you take a closer look at it. And whenever somebody rides, like from far away, mm-hmm. it's a stunt guy. But the problem is, after this movie, he became a lot. He got a lot of offerings for westerns.
Couldn't take a single one.
Yeah, I'm guessing not.
It would have been good to see him in a western.
I think he was in. I think he was in Heaven's Gate. Pretty sure that he. Or was that Chris? I think Christopher Walken was in Heaven's Gate. I mean, he was also like in Vietnam stuff. He was in some Spielberg stuff. He shows up all the time. He still works here and there. He's a wonderfully weird actor. We talked about him on our Batman Returns episode in 90s Christmas.
Yeah, he's been in tons of stuff.
Oh, so much.
Over 100.
So many things. And despite this film taking place in New England, it was actually shot in England. The whole little town of Sleepy Hollow was built in Buckinghamshire. The interiors were filmed in the London Leavesden Studios. And even though there are more than a few scenes which are clearly filmed outside, Burton wanted the movie to have an old school and atmospheric feel. So they also built a lot of the outside locations in the studio.
Okay.
So they could control the weather and the mood. And all of that. There's also a quote about this I have right here. About the thing like shooting in the studio. The location look. And like a stage pumping a lot of smoke into the atmosphere. Somebody said, I think it was Burton, like Hammer Films did that quite a lot. Trying to make the exteriors look like a stage. And the stage look like an exterior. All those great Hammer horror films had such a beautiful atmosphere. That was another of the reasons why I wanted to do this film. Very, very... The building of the town, of the outside town, took about 4 months. And the fake forests built on the sound stages became real forests by the time they wrapped. They became infested with bugs and birds. And the sound of birds in the movie are often that of real uninvited creatures that had made their homes in the trees.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, it did look really creepy, really old-timey. They did a great job with that.
Absolutely, which also, I mean, the way the movie is shot. Like, I think they shot this whole thing with special filters, a lot of blue filters, and they had the color of the blood actually had to be like bright orange to be able to look like red through the filters, and they did on this thing what strikes you right away and still today. This is a visual feast. Like, it looks incredible. Like, unlike so many other movies. And this whole atmosphere, like, sucks you in immediately. Mm-hmm. This was actually, on all the visual aspects, it was nominated. It was nominated for 3 Academy Awards. Emmanuel Lubezki's cinematography, Colleen Edwards' costumes, and Rick Heinrich's production design. But only Heinrich's won. Which is fitting because he had already worked with Burton on numerous projects even before both of their careers took off.
Yeah,
which is really cool. In his acceptance speech, he said this wonderful quote here: "I share this award with an artist whose unique brilliance I got a glimpse of 20 years ago, Tim Burton, whose vision of Sleepy Hollow was the inspiration we all keyed off."
No, very fitting.
Exactly. It looks so. I mean, I hope you watched it in a proper mood, because this is just such an autumn film, which is great. And then fall, it's a fall film.
Yes, it definitely is. I was watching it, and it was very hot in my studio when I did it, so I didn't really get the fall feeling. But I mean, it instantly got my attention. Instantly made me feel like it's something I wanted to keep watching.
Oh, it looks so great, especially because it's so much muted colors in this. Some of the, I think they even toyed with the decision of shooting it in black and white and with a certain aspect ratio, but that didn't came into fruition. So they shot it with these special lenses, and sometimes it looks so muted and almost black and white, that which makes it pop even more when bright colors pop up.
Yeah,
especially the blood and certain clothes too, which makes also the finale, the final shot, make it stand out a lot.
Yeah, it does look very muted. It looks like if you were watching a movie from this time period, that's probably what it looked like. Those colors. It looks like it's very old-timey like cameras. That's,
oh yeah,
to me at least, that's what it feels like. Well, this so was 20 much. Years ago too, so.
Although it's really fitting in the way how there are a lot of British actors in this. I mean, it was shot in England, so that was a part of it. But also in terms of Sleepy Hollow, I think it was like a Dutch community originally, or least with some people from that area, which I think also the windmill might kind of be a nod to that, and also how the windmill is burning down. That is actually a reference to Frankenstein. And Burton did the same thing in Frankenweenie, his long version of Frankenweenie. And I think it's also in the old one he did, he does it as well. A lot of windmills burning in Tim Burton films. which I think was like a miniature, like a certain scaled miniature. Which is really cool, because in terms of the effects, they use quite the variety. We have a lot of sets, they have map paintings in certain scenes. I think miniatures for the exploding windmill, for example, and they use CGI, which is used mostly very well, especially for the horseman himself. Did you know how they did it?
No, green screen?
No. The stuntman wore a blue ski mask, masking his whole head, and they keyed it out. And most of the other CGI is so brief that it holds up very well. They used CGI to key out his head, but also they used CGI to recreate his collar, to make it not make it like stand out, to see oh, there's an actual head there. So whenever you see the horseman that collar on his vest, that isn't there either in reality. They had to CGI there to give you the illusion that it wasn't actually a head, like moving the collar in certain spots. So that's actually impressive.
It is. I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
As the horseman's making his head movements, you would be able to see
absolutely.
That.
It's weird. But yeah, it's really cool. With mostly the CGI, where they do it here and there, it holds up pretty well, with the exception of maybe like one or two small parts where you can clearly tell there's one decapitation where you can tell, okay, yeah, this is clearly done with CG, and there's the part where like the snake eyes come out.
Yeah, you mean you weren't there wasn't any real beheadings on this one?
I mean you can do beheadings with practical stuff, and mostly they use like this they use this mixture of puppets and CGI and all of that. I've seen behind the scenes things where they use like these practical stand-ins and they have real heads rolling around and all of that. And sometimes, wow. I mean, of when they like enter and exit the gates of hell or whatever it is, like that's done with CGI. I have seen behind the scenes footage. They were really ambitious with this stuff. Like they really wanted to make it look interesting and cool. But also I think it's fitting that some of the effects look kind of goofy nowadays, because that fits right in with the overall tone and the feeling of a film they want to create, which is like, yeah, this was homage to the Hammer horror films, which also had a mixture of pretty good effects and kind of weird cheesy effects.
Yeah, they looked nice. I mean, a lot of the effects they look great to me. It looks like it's part of what's supposed to happen. It doesn't look like it's cheesy or anything.
Oh no, nothing really stands out in terms of this doesn't fit in here quite well. No, it all comes together. I mean, the biggest CGI scene is when the muscles and skin and hair grow back on the skull, and that still looks pretty cool. That's really cool how we do it. I think it was ILM who worked on the effects. I'm not quite sure, but that was 99, when this was a couple of years after Jurassic Park, but it was still when CGI was in its baby legs in a way, when they were still trying out new things. And this uses it appropriately in a lot of ways, which makes it, I mean, and the way how it looks aged on purpose in terms of the tone and the style, mm-hmm. that makes it age very well. Like when you watch it today, or when you watch it with maybe like a person who is used to more modern horror films, I don't think he would really say, oh, this looks dated, because it's so clearly the intention that it's supposed
that
to
it
be
is dated,
kind of
yeah.
old yeah but it's supposed to be old fashioned.
Well, to me it looks old fashioned, so
but on purpose, of course.
Yeah,
so we have all of these things out of the way. Let's talk briefly about the actual story, I guess. Maybe you can sum it up, what happens in the movie.
So what happens is Ichabod Crane wants to examine stuff. he's like an examiner. That's what I got immediately, that he wants to figure out how things work, what is actually causing what, because he wants to, at the very beginning, he wants to like examine a body, and everyone's like, why are you gonna examine a body? It drowned. It's in the water. It drowned. Case closed. And he's like, no, but I mean, how do we know that the person didn't die before they went into the water? And I think that they sent him to Sleepy Hollow because of people are getting beheaded, just to get him out of the way.
Oh yeah, it's certainly one of the reasons that they sent him there. Like you want to deduct some cases, you go just to leave us alone, which is the plot of a lot of movies. This is clearly a take on this kind of like city policeman goes into small town. It doesn't expect that big of a deal, and then it turns out it's something that's way over its head. I mean, if you want to see basically a comedic version of this, watch Hot Fuzz.
Yeah. Rush Hour is also the same thing.
Oh yeah, Rush Hour, they do that. The Wicker Man is kind of the same plot too. The same concept, where a guy goes into this secluded place, and it turns out there's something weird going on. I mean, there are a lot of movies which do that, and this one does it pretty well. And yeah, when he arrives, what happens?
So he gets to Sleepy Hollow, and he tries to figure out who's killing all of these people. There's been four beheadings that's happened, or three. And then I think at one point they say that they're in like the late 1800s. They're about to go into the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Were they still wearing this type of clothing close to the turn of the century? Because I thought literally in 20 years, everyone was like in modern suits, like in 1920. Because this looks like it's from like the 1700s.
Guard. I think it's definitely, I mean, it's kind of like this backwards thing, how we call the 19th century, the 18th century and all of that. And I think it's 17... I think it takes place in like 1799.
So they were in 17th. Gotcha. Okay, that's kind of where I got confused. I thought for sure that they said that they were going into the 19th. So I was like, okay.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure it takes place there.
All the beheadings are happening. He's on his way to Sleepy Hollow to figure out what's going on. And then as he's going to Sleepy Hollow, the credits are rolling. And then all of a sudden, I see music by Danny Elfman. Then I think in my head, of course, Lasse would want this one.
I mean, it's Tim Burton. What do you expect? That's actually something I really love about this. Like, it's a shame that he wasn't nominated for an Oscar, because this is one of his best scores easily. I even wrote a detailed review about it for One Halloween a few years ago. It's basically monothematical, but he works wonders with a theme. He creates so many moods and variations with it, and it features some of the most loud and brutal action cues he's ever done, and it's very fitting that as his name appears in the opening credits, there's a bombastic orchestra sting.
There is. That's what made me notice it even more.
Yeah, I love it so much when his name comes up. It's so great. But yeah,
but anyways, after I got over my thanks Lasse thing, he gets to the town, and I instantly notice that there's a lot of jack-o'-lanterns everywhere. And this next part, I was a little like, it's total different time. Like, he gets to this house and there's like a party going on, and mm-hmm. he introduces himself, and they basically like it. I don't think it's a hotel, and the guy just says, "Oh yeah, you can stay with us."
Oh yeah, it's just this big
dated thing.
This big farmhouse, basically, of the richest man in town.
Yeah, that just seems so weird to me that some stranger just comes up to someone's house and then they say, "Oh yeah, you can stay with us here." You show him to his quarters. It just seems so weird that they do that.
I think that's just he says you're allowed to stay in terms of you can be part of this little feast. And then he introduces himself as, "No, I'm actually this guy sent from New York." And then he says, "Okay, you can set up quarters here, but so things won't be as complicated." I think that's the reason.
That's just so weird. And then they start learning. They tell him about the Headless Horseman. They tell him the legend. And he's like, "I don't believe it. It's somebody is causing this." So as he's like investigating, he slowly starts realizing that, oh, maybe it's not somebody. Maybe it really is something. He gets a little weird. He's very eccentric. He's very awkward, and that's what like that kind of turned me off a little bit, because I instantly, like, from what I remembered, I thought he was more of like, "No, let's go get this thing, whatever it is." Everyone rallies against them, they go off, figure out how to kill it, they kill it, happy ending. That's what I thought, but in reality it's everyone's getting picked off one by one. There's this epic fight scene with Brom versus the Sleepy Hollow guy and the Headless Horseman. They're battling. He gets involved. That was probably the most entertaining thing to me, was when they were fighting.
Oh, yeah, that fight is great, like, especially when he just literally gets cut in half.
He gets cut in half, but, like, he would have survived if he would have just left him alone. Like, he wasn't...
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Even Ichabod Crane comes up to him and says, "He's not after you, just leave him alone." And
that's one of the best moments. Like, I love the part when the horseman just walks by Brom and doesn't attack people, unless they are a true hindrance to him or are victims he's out for. Like, it looks so menacing when he is just stoically walking, which is a great moment, because it tells us something about his motivation, so to speak. Like, that tells you that it's one of the hints where it's like, oh, there's something going on. He just doesn't kill random people. There's some kind of plan going on, which is really great visual storytelling. And then later he emphasizes he's not after you. So that's really cool.
Yeah, because I think it happens a couple of times where Ichabod Crane's like in the way and the Headless Horseman just leaves him alone.
When he kills the mayor and he just rides by him and he's out for the mayor. But that's so quickly that it's just, I don't know, maybe he just got out of the way in time. So there you don't really pay attention. But later on, in the case of Brom, there you're like, oh, there's something here.
Yeah. So then you start realizing something's going on. He starts trying to put all of the pieces together. The little boy was like, for whatever reason, I really gravitated towards that because he just had both of his parents killed. And he's like, I don't know, a 10-year-old boy, 12-year-old, something like that.
I think it was like 12 to 14, maybe, he looked like to me. But yeah, he basically had to be this man already.
With his companion
doing grown-up things.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, what happens in this situation back then? Like, does nobody, like, take the boy in? Like, is he just, like, I guess, like, he's got to find somebody to go to, so... He wants revenge, so he says, "Hey, I'm not scared like these guys. Why don't you take me with you, and I'll help you out with whatever you need." First, he doesn't want him, and then he says, "No, okay, well." So, as soon as he finds out that both his parents are killed by the horsemen, he goes, "Oh, okay, well, come join me." And he does, he does a good job.
Yeah, he warms up to him, and he's the only one willing to. Accompany
to
him
help.
To the woods. Like he's the one guy who doesn't seem to be that scared, who's actually who's basically, I guess, sometimes he reacts in a certain way, but for the most part he's pretty like proactive, like always carrying a rifle, shooting it when they are in the church. He really tries to help, and he sneaks into the mill later on too, when he realizes that something weird is going on. So yeah, there's a certain portion where he's on his own and is trying to figure stuff out. So yeah, a good motivation, good pairing too. And how also Katrina, Christina Ricci, her character Katrina, how she gets involved and tries to help. There's some cool stuff. But yeah, and it turns out to be this huge, complicated detective story, and he almost serves the case. But yeah, it turns out that he's wrong in several ways. And then later it's explained to us what actually happens.
Yeah, it's first he thinks that it's her, and then it's the little boy that makes him rethink that maybe it's not her. I think with something he says when they're driving away, or something he thinks about when they're driving away. I don't know. Towards the end, it kind of seemed like they were trying to sum everything up really, really fast. So I probably missed a couple of key things, but. It turns out that it was the mother-in-law, was it?
Yeah, the stepmother.
Yeah, it had something to do with who was going to get the estate of somebody. Like, they were trying to get rid of all of the next of kins, whoever was next in line to get the estate. I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
Yeah, that's one sad part. The evil plan of Miranda Richardson doesn't make sense. Because if her whole motivation... is to get the money of her now dead husband. Why did she pretend like the horseman also killed her? Wouldn't that raise a lot of questions among the townsfolk when she just suddenly turns big up?
Yeah, it's... I don't know. As soon as that stuff started happening, I was like, I'm really trying to follow, but I don't know. I think it's just too hot in here.
But that's also one of the throwbacks to the Hammer films, which were like this hugely complicated affair only briefly being about the actual plot of the stories they were based on, like Dracula, Frankenstein, the Mummy, all of that. They made it much more elaborate and complicated, and this fits right in, but this is like kind of like a plot hole where I'm like, oh no, sorry, I mean all of your like revenge plot, this is pretty sound, but when you're going out of your way to killing like a maid and even scarring her hand so people think it's you. No, at that point, you're screwed. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, so it got all weird towards the end. But then the Headless Horseman was going after Katrina to try to get rid of her. They fight. There's like this big elaborate chasing scene, which was pretty cool.
Oh yeah, that's really one of the highlights.
And then yeah, somehow the mom or whoever it is gets back in the way, and the Ichabod Crane throws the skull because she had the skull the mom did, and she was the one that was controlling the Headless Horseman. He grabs the skull, throws it at the Headless Horseman. He puts it on, and he turns back into his. Human, I guess, if that's what you want to call himself.
Kind of like a demonic human version with these glowing eyes and
yeah,
and all of that. And then, yeah, he takes the mother to with him to hell, I guess.
Yeah, to be his bride forever. Gives her a big old smooch, and then off they go, right off into the sunset.
Great ending. And then right before the new century begins, they are in New York, and the young Maspeth is with them. It's kind of like, I guess they adopt him now, or maybe he is like their young butler or servant or whatever, but he has a new family in this case, which is really nice.
Yeah, that's always good that he'll be at least taken care of, even though he'll probably have to work for the rest of his life, but he's a good sidekick.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
All right, everyone, Lyle here. So I kind of split this one up into two parts because me and Lassa kind of went far into more detail about the trivia and all of the stuff that we thought about the movie. So I split it up into two, or else this would be like an hour and a half long episode. So to kind of give you guys a little bit of a break, come back tomorrow and you will hear the rest of the discussion. So that's going to do it for day 10 of It's a 90s Halloween Countdown. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you'd like to support the show, you can do it a couple of different ways. You can go to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star review. Trust me, those do help. You can also go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/thehalloweenpod and help us out with a monthly donation. If you become a mega fan for the Halloween podcast, then that means that you get your very own sponsored show, an extra show. And if I get any within the 31 show countdown, then that just means you guys get an extra show above the 31 for the month of October. So please support this show by going to patreon.com/thehalloweenpod and get signed up. If you have any questions, comments, or want to suggest anything for a future show, just go ahead and send those to thehalloweenpodcast@gmail.com. You could also find us on Twitter @thehalloweenpod. And don't forget about our Facebook page, facebook.com/thehalloweenpodcast. All right, guys, I will see you again tomorrow for part 2 of the Sleepy Hollow discussion. Have a good night.